Welcome to the Motley Fool Radio Show. I'm David Gardner, broadcasting from Fool Global Headquarters here in Alexandria, Virginia, here each week to talk about the motley world of money and investing. And on this week's show, we'll talk to billionaire basketball owner and investor Mark Cuban, a motley guy if ever there was one. He'll share some of his favorite investments. We'll also play our game Taking Stock later in the show and, of course, take your phone calls. But we begin this week's show by talking about dollars and cents, European style. Voters in France and Holland gave a thumbs down this week to the proposed EU constitution, and the euro continued its decline. Here to tell us more about it and some of this week's other news is Fool Radio economics contributor Charlie Whelan, the author of Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. He joins us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago, Illinois. Charlie Whelan, welcome back to the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Good to be with you.
Charlie, let's begin by talking this week about the economic situation in Europe. I just referenced voters in France and Holland voting against a proposed EU constitution. The euro continues to decline. Charlie, what does it all mean?
Well, some of the sentiment against the EU involved some issues of principle. Do you want to give away more sovereignty to a unified Europe? That may mean some, obviously means some loss of national sovereignty. It may mean some defense policy gets devolved to Europe as a whole, much as the introduction of the euro, the currency, meant that you had to give up your national currency. So part of that is what's involved. But also, particularly when you look at France, there seems to be an economic discontent that is manifesting itself in the vote, that people are looking around. France has unemployment that's almost 10%. If you look across to Germany, you've got this staggering unemployment rate of 12%. And it seems to be, as elections are in this country and elsewhere, somehow a referendum on the leadership in these countries, and that was a vote down.
And one more question about the euro. Naturally, it occurs to us, Charlie, with the decline of the euro, does it mean we Americans this summer should buy our airline tickets to Paris?
Well, Paris just got a little bit cheaper, as did the BMW you may have been ogling, or any other foreign product that comes out of Europe. The American dollar obviously stronger when the euro falls. Now, it's not all great news for the United States. If you're Boeing and your main competitor is Airbus, suddenly Airbus just got a little cheaper for the rest of the world. So anytime currencies move, it cuts both ways for people in the United States. For Americans trying to sell their products abroad, if the dollar gets stronger, their products become relatively more expensive. For Americans buying foreign products, it's all good news, and going on vacation in Europe becomes a lot cheaper. I think there's actually a second interesting point to this move in the euro, which is, if you remember, about 6 weeks ago, we were talking about the weakness of the dollar. And many of the extant factors that led to a weak dollar, such as the concern over whether the East Asian central banks might diversify their currency holdings, the large and growing trade deficit, and so on, those things are still in place. So I think that's one thing to register, is you've got this short-term setback to the euro, but long-term, there's still some reasons to be worried about the dollar. The second is from an investment perspective. If you're somebody who read all those articles 6 weeks ago about how the dollar had nowhere to go but down, and you went out and made a currency play, you're probably smarting pretty good right now. Mm. And so I think the larger lesson is, if you think you can read the newspaper and predict some major movement of a market, whether it's currency, stock market, bond market, or so on, it's a pretty dangerous game.
Mm. Well put. Charlie, let's turn our attention now to the U.S. and talk about the minimum wage. Wisconsin became the latest state to raise its minimum wage this week. Employers there must now pay at least $5.70 an hour through June 2006, when the minimum wage rises again to $6.50 an hour. The federal minimum wage, as you know, is $5.15. Charlie, you know, a lot of us hear that number and think, well, $5.15, that's not much at all. Sure, why not raise that?
Well, it's a really interesting policy issue, because for most people, they think of it as kind of a proletariat versus capitalist issue, that if you raise the minimum wage, more money goes into the workers' pockets, and it comes at the expense of those who employ them, so people in the hospitality industry, restaurant owners, and so on. And there is certainly some truth to that. But the more interesting angle is whether and to what extent you can really help workers by raising the minimum wage. And the reason for that is, at some point, you start to see a trade-off, that if you are running a restaurant or an amusement or park or something like that, and you're hiring a lot of minimum wage workers, and those workers become more expensive, what you may do is start to cut back on the number of those low-wage workers you happen to hire. And you may either replace them with fewer higher-paid employees, so you opt instead for more human capital, or more likely, you may replace them with technology. If you look at the broad trends in society, we see ATM machines and phone trees instead of secretaries and automated parking lots. Mm. I've actually seen grocery stores now where you scan your own groceries. So the question is, at what point, by raising the minimum wage, do you actually cause job loss among the folks at that end of the labor pool because they get more expensive than they're actually worth to the prospective employers? So if your social perspective is we should help workers somehow, there are other ways of doing it that don't have the disemployment effects. So, for example, economists are much keener on the earned income tax credit, which says basically the employer is going to pay you what he pays you. You know, it may be $3 an hour, it may be $4 an hour. But if you're in the labor pool and at the end of the year you've made $13,000 or something like that, and we make a social decision that we want everybody who's working to earn, say, $25,000 if you've got a family, what the earned income tax credit does is provide a subsidy between what you make and whatever level you think people ought to make. Mm. And what the benefit of that is that there's no deterrent to employment. You're not forcing that cost on the employer, and therefore the employer is not likely to shed employees as a result. They're still paying $3 or $4, whatever that employee is worth. Now, the cost, obviously, is that the government's got to pay the difference, and it means higher taxes somewhere else.
Charlie Whelan is the author of Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. Charlie, thanks for joining us once again. And have a lovely weekend.
It was a pleasure. Always good to be with you.